So I'd like to welcome everybody to this second instalment of the Cultural Studies podcast. My name's Toby Miller, and I'm very pleased to welcome into the pod today a friend of mine and someone whose work I've admired even longer than we've had a friendship, and that is Douglas Kellner. Doug is a professor at the University of California, Los Angeles. Before that, he was at the University of Texas, Austin. But he's renowned as a public intellectual, a philosopher, a cultural studies person, a media studies person, communication studies, an educationalist, an educator, you name it, really, within the whole realm of the human sciences. And he's also one of the people who, very unusually, manages successfully to straddle, negotiate, move between, if you like, what are often thought of as incommensurables, namely Frankfurt School forms of critique and cultural studies forms of theory slash engaged, grounded analysis. And I wanted to talk about Doug's trajectory and his history and his interests, but rather than begin at the beginning, I want, in Godard-like way, to begin somewhere else, namely not at the end, but right now in the present. And I wonder, Doug, if you could tell us a little bit about your current concerns, what's interesting you, and so on.
Well, Toby, I just published a book with Blackwell called Cinema Wars that's on the politics and ideology of Hollywood film during the 2000s.
Excuse me, keep okay. Going, Doug.
Now I'm going to wait. Is that the mail dude that delivers it to you?
I think it's the revolution. The revolution's just been delivered by FedEx.
Oh, okay. Very cool. That's nice. They bring it right to your apartment.
Absolutely. Well, the revolution is not always televised, but it is home delivered.
Okay.
So, okay, Cinema Wars, the new book.
Which is on the politics and ideology of Hollywood film in the 2000s, which is the Bush-Cheney era and the transition to the Obama era. And I basically talk about how this has played out, how all the political, cultural wars took place within Hollywood cinema during the Bush-Cheney years, and then how Hollywood film anticipated Obama. In particular, how there were some films that transcoded conservative discourses that would support the militarism, the conservatism, the patriarchy of the Bush-Cheney era. But there were also many films that contested conservative ideology, and particularly documentary films on Iraq, Afghanistan, Bush-Cheney policy. So I argue that during the 2000s, Hollywood film is very much a contested terrain. And I highlighted the moments of critique, where you have Michael Moore's great documentaries, Robert Greenwald, his series of brave new films, which are on everything, Iraq, the foreign policy, the domestic corporate policy.
Fox News.
Yeah. Exactly. So once I finished that book, I really hadn't done justice to the politics of representation, the wars over gender, sexuality, class, race, and ethnicity. Mm-hmm. So I'm currently working on a book on that. That will be a follow-up, a second volume of the Cinema Wars.
Oh, fantastic. Now, in terms of the relationship between macro politics, geopolitics, electoral politics, and Hollywood, you're obviously suggesting it's a contested one in this new book, which I've had the great privilege to look at. It's terrific, everybody. But I'm wondering what seem to be the mechanisms in your view for that correlation. In other words, and this is something I get asked a lot by people from other countries, I'm sure you do too, is it that there's a man in the Motion Picture Association of America's office in D.C. sitting next to a man or a woman from the State Department or the Commerce Department of the United States government agreeing on what will happen? Is it a reflectionist notion whereby art follows society, or is it something else that allows for this kind of connection to be drawn?
Well, it's a very complicated process. I used the concept of transcoding to argue how cinema transcodes or translates into cinematic form the political struggles, issues of the day. And this takes place through a very complex apparatus, which is Hollywood film, which you've actually written quite a bit on production and globalization. So on one hand, there's a production process that involves studios, it involves directors, and each film is a very complex negotiation between writers, directors, actors, the whole apparatus of production. On the other hand, there are conservatives in the industry, there are liberals, and there are people with contradictions, and they tend to reproduce their own politics in the films that they play in. Now again, sometimes, and particularly with documentary, it's very clear, Michael Moore and Robert Greenwald want to carry out a left-wing critique of corporate capitalism, conservatism, Bush-Cheney administration, etc. And with some filmmakers, though, it's more of a political unconscious. They're sort of instinctively conservative or radical, etc. And often contradictory and ambiguous.
Now, that's a nice way to take us back to the past, because you invoke the political unconscious in just what you just said. I've recently been reading a paper you wrote about a decade ago called Philosophical Adventures. And obviously there are echoes in what you just said of Frederick Jameson's notion of a political unconscious. So could you take us back a little bit to this, your origins, if you like, your interests in the Frankfurt School, which of course come before your engagement with Jameson, but how that history helps you and what it means to you and how you came to where you sit today?
Well, first of all, let me thank you for having this interview on how I got into cultural studies and my trajectory of cultural studies, because I really hadn't reflected on this before. In my philosophical adventures, it was mostly from the standpoint of philosophy and social theory, of how I took Marxism and critical theory that I was into in the 1960s and then combined it with postmodern theory that I got into in studying in France from 71 to 72, and how I mediated those philosophical theoretical currents in my work. But I left out of the philosophical adventures of how I got into cultural studies. And it was actually through the Frankfurt School initially, where doing work on critical social theory in the 1970s at the University of Texas, I came to the conclusion that Adorno and Horkheimer were correct, although with complications that will come up later, in their theory of the consciousness industry, the culture industry, that basically mass communication and media was the major force that was shaping identities, socialization, politics, etc., that American culture was constructed to a large extent through the culture industries, and this had to do with everything from economics and advertising to politics and political struggles. So I started having study groups on media theory, and I decided in the 1970s to do a course at the University of Texas on philosophy of culture and communication, where I used McLuhan, who had the great media theory of different media construct different eras of culture and different forms of communication and identities. I did the Frankfurt School, and then I did other books, readers on film theory or television, etc. And I saw that the main problem with the Frankfurt School, their critique of the culture industries, was that it was too one-dimensional. It was too monolithic in culture as a form of domination, where from the 1960s, my experience of folk music, rock and roll, Bob Dylan, Beatles, Stones, etc., obviously, popular culture was also a force of opposition. And this was also the case, obviously, in film like Easy Rider and the youth films. But even in television, I saw critical oppositional moments, if not radical opposition.
Well, if I could cut in there for a moment, it's an interesting moment to think about the fact that whilst in a lot of cultural studies histories and hagiographies and critiques, an opposition is clearly drawn between cultural studies and the Frankfurt School, but if you go back to the late 60s in the United States, Marcuse was a culture hero for the youth movement, was he not? And popular culture, even if he didn't want necessarily to be this, he was that.
And obviously Herbert Marcuse was probably the single major influence on me.
Yeah.
My first book was on Herbert Marcuse and the Crisis of Marxism, my first big book. And I've been editing the collected papers of Herbert Marcuse and are just about to put to press the fifth volume on philosophy, psychoanalysis, emancipation. So I've looked through everything, or at everything, from a Marcusean lens. But he's also wrong, to a certain extent, on one-dimensional society failing to see the contradictions, the crisis tensions, the struggles, and to see how these are reproduced in popular culture. So I needed a theoretical apparatus that would articulate this sense of struggle and contestation within popular culture. And on one hand, I got it from Gramsci, whose prison notebooks and other writings basically presented popular culture or culture in general as a contested terrain. So from Gramsci, I got that slogan that popular culture, film, media are a contested terrain. But I needed more on the audience and what the audience does with media culture and constructs meanings, etc. So I heard rumors of a Birmingham school and a school of cultural studies in England. I read some articles about it. So I sent Stuart Hall a letter saying I was very interested in cultural studies. I was a professor at the University of Texas. I was offering a course for some years on philosophy of culture and communication. And I would like to come, this was a little bit cheeky on my part, and either study for a year, a semester, or teach at the Birmingham school. So Stuart wrote me a three-page, single-spaced, typewritten letter back explaining the whole history of cultural studies and giving me a stack of his stenciled papers, a couple of which I'd already gotten from other people that introduced me to cultural studies. Stuart Hall's Encoding, Decoding papers, obviously foundational for cultural studies. So I see that put the active audience in the story. But of course, Stuart told me, look, we're a very small sub-department in the English department. We have one or two people teaching, and you know, we can't hire outside professors, but we'd love to have you come visit someday, etc.
And this is while you're this is while you've been teaching this seminar.
This is probably late '70s. By now, maybe even the early 1980s, because it was a few years after that exchange with Stuart Hall that I met him at this famous conference on Marxism and postmodernism in University of Illinois at Urbana, which, by the way, set my research agenda. That conference for the next three decades, because I heard Frederick Jameson's article or paper on Marxism and postmodernism. Postmodernism, the cultural logic of capital, that basically set the terms for and inaugurated the debates over postmodernism. And I already met Jameson, read his work, knew him fairly well. So this got me into postmodernism. And then I heard Stuart Hall present on cultural studies. I had dinner with him. And of course, Larry Grossberg at that time was actively promoting cultural studies, and I'd known him for some years. So I got into both postmodern theory and cultural studies as an outcome of that Urbana conference.
Interesting. And so this is a moment then when, if we think about the Frankfurt School as being interested sometimes empirically in these questions of production and consumption. One thinks about Adorno working on soap opera listeners and so on, but also had a theoretical position, if you like, a conceptual understanding of production that said where there is an industrial mode of production, whether it's culture or cars, you're going to get the same kind of product produced because that's how economies of scale will dictate things. And juxtaposing this in some sense with the notion of a more critical attitude that derives from a more modernist consciousness, right, where life in the German philosophical tradition becomes an object of critique for you rather than simply of acceptance, if you like. I'm putting it very crudely. Now, what you're doing is trying to go beyond that to say, well, the psychoanalytic models and the understandings of a mode of production and the notion of the avant-garde consciousness all have their place, but so does a notion of contestation, in a Gramscian sense, and also some kind of engagement with how people actually make sense of these texts when they're presented to them. Is that...
That's a very accurate way of describing how I tried to put different pieces of a theory together, that when I articulated it in a meta-theory of cultural studies in my book, Media Culture, published in 1995, that was my first systematic work on cultural studies that brought together oh, a decade or two of studies that I'd done of U.S. culture, popular culture in particular, but also doing this theoretical work. And I came up with the term a multi-perspectival cultural studies, that on one hand, it's a combining of production, textual analysis, and audience interpretation of text that is what I guess Raymond Williams, Stuart Hall described as the circuit of culture going from production to text to distribution, et cetera, and the production of meanings. But also I wanted a multi-perspectival cultural studies in the sense of theory, where I would combine critical theory of society, psychoanalysis, different cultural theories, and different theories of interpretation, like Marxism, feminism, post-structuralism, semiotics, psychoanalysis, all the theories of interpretation. Each theory of interpretation gave you a perspective on a text of media culture. So I wanted to bring as many perspectives as possible, and of course get on the perspectives of race, class, gender, sexuality, etc., that were involved in all cultural texts in one way or another.
And a lot of this is going on when you're, once you've done your studies in the US, in Germany, in France, a lot of this is going on at the University of Texas at Austin in the philosophy department, isn't it? Which is interesting because my outsider understanding of philosophy in the US is that it's very Anglo-American dominated, which is to say the analytic model. So what was that like as a place to be doing this kind of A, empirically grounded work, but B, political work?
This is very anomalous. I was perhaps one of the few philosophers in the United States that was able to pretty much do whatever I wanted and chose to do critical theory as well, continental philosophy as well as cultural studies. And it was the fortunate accident that the University of Texas was the biggest philosophy department in the United States.
Really?
It was also, when I was hired in 1973, one of the most pluralist. So they had American philosophers, continental analytic philosophers. I was actually hired to teach Marxism, which is actually quite ironic.
I shouldn't laugh.
You should laugh because
well,
it's
wife,
the University of Texas at Austin.
Doug's wife, Rhonda Hammer, is here as well, and we're both laughing at the same moments. You might be able to hear her laughter as well as mine when Doug says, I was hired to teach Marxism.
It was the only job in Marxism in the United States in a philosophy department, where in a pluralist department, they put aside a position. As soon as I left, it disappeared. But so I was hired to teach Marxism. So I taught Marxist philosophy. I taught critical theory. But I started teaching seminars in philosophies of interpretation that fit right into continental philosophy. But I also, it was such a big department, I could teach this course, philosophy of culture and communication, where I used philosophy as a cover to do media and television and film and popular music studies. So it just happened that this was a very big, very open department, and I got tenure. So once you get tenure, you can do pretty much what you want. I was doing what I was hired to do.
And there are notorious tales within cultural studies of people being invited to appear on your television program, sitting around with a bottle of wine and chatting about philosophy and politics and culture. Can you tell us a bit about that TV program and whether or not the mythological account is accurate?
The mythologies are partially true. But in 1978, I started to do a public access program called Alternative Views.
What? There's a link to it.
There's a link to that TV series, is there?
Actually, most of it is now on the internet. There's a public access archive that has, I'd say, 400 or so of the 600 Alternative Views TV shows linked and archived. And on my website, I have 30 or 40. And this involved people like Noam Chomsky, Herbert Schiller, the communication theorists, Helen Caldicott, the anti-nuclear activist, Stokely Carmichael, the radical Black Power dude, Cesar Chavez, the labor organizer, Emil D'Antonio, the radical documentary filmmaker. So every time someone interesting and radical came through Austin, Texas, we got them on our show. No one turned us down. everyone that came into town wanted to be on television. You said you had a public access TV show, and they said yes. And I guess it got a reputation among the left. And in fact, after about 6 years, we started being shown in New York City in the 1980s. CUNY broadcasted it on their channel, and this guy, Corliss Lamont, a millionaire, leased 8 showings a week on public access in New York. So it was shown about 15 times a week in New York. So I was actually a minor celebrity in the 1980s. I'd come into the subway and buy a token, and a guy said, "Oh, you're Doug Kellner of University of Texas. You do alternative views." And so then I'd give him an autograph, and he said, every day at lunch, he'd go watch the show. His wife would videotape it for him.
Wonderful. Now, and that is a way of doing cultural studies that's very public, isn't it?
Correct. That was really a great experience, a great opportunity. I should argue that, or note that my partner, Rhonda Hammer, who's here, was at the same time inaugurating a teaching of cultural studies and media literacy through media production, where she was teaching at Windsor University in Kansas and now teaches at...
Right. What's the difference between Kansas and Canada?
Little Freudian slip there. Windsor University in Canada, in the Great White North.
Which is actually south of Detroit.
It's adjacent.
Adjacent, let's say.
Detroit adjacent.
Detroit adjacent, not Beverly Hills adjacent, right. But Detroit adjacent.
Right. So at the same time that I was doing the public access TV, Rhonda's students were producing soap operas and advertisements and documentaries, teaching the codes of media culture, of advertising, and representing gender, race, and sexuality, etc. And that's actually how we met. Were through conferences that were mostly alternative media ones. Since I was doing the public access alternative views and she was teaching her students to do alternative media.
Well, this is jumping ahead a bit, but just staying on the topic of you and Rhonda, if I may, you've recently edited a book together as well, haven't you?
Yes, a big media cultural studies reader, which, by the way, brings me to a meta-theory point before I talk about that book.
Yeah.
My own work has been combining cultural studies with media studies. We left out of the narrative the book that I did on film with Michael Ryan, Camera Politica. So Michael and I did a book on politics and ideology of Hollywood film from 1967 up into the mid-80s.
And diagnostic critique.
And we there developed the notion of diagnostic critique. I think we used the term contested terrain. So a lot of the ideas I was developing and others and Michael on cultural studies came into that book, Camera Politica. But then, to get back to my narrative, so on one hand, I'm really studying television, popular music, and film, but I'm also very interested in media and politics. Mm-hmm. I'm a political junkie, and I'm watching TV news, critiquing it, documentary film, and TV documentaries a great interest in mine. And particularly with the Grand Theft 2000, which is the title of a book I did on the stolen election of 2000, was very much on media and politics. And I did a trilogy of books on media and politics and did a lot of work in communication studies, media studies. So the paradigm that Rhonda and I developed in our book was a media slash cultural studies. Mm. That although cultural studies in the Birmingham School model in your work and other versions pays lip service to production, and people like you have actually done production studies, for the most part, cultural studies tended to be either textualist or audience studies, so where production really sort of fell away. Whereas media communication studies, there was a robust tradition of political economy and production studies.
Actually, we drew a lot on Toby's work on your introduction to cultural studies edited book and your intro in there where you talk about this kind of dialectical relationship.
Oh, thanks.
So, no, we did. It was a terrific read and very important for us.
So we wanted to combine media communication series with cultural studies, the argument being that the limitation of cultural studies was, on one hand, it hadn't really engaged production, with exceptions like yourself, but also there's very little cultural studies of news, of documentaries, of media and politics, as it were, whereas obviously media communication studies did that. So I found that I was doing both entertainment and properly the field of cultural studies as it was being constructed globally, but also media communication studies. Mm-hmm. So I said, look, Ryan and I are just going to do a meta theory, media/cultural studies. Rhonda did her MA thesis in Simon Fraser on communications on
in
Bateson.
Kansas.
Again, in the Great White North. And she had also done a lot of work on television. So we share, actually with you, I think, with this media/cultural studies meta theory. So in the introduction, we worked out the meta theory and went through the history of cultural studies, but also media communication studies, and then how we were combining them. Very Hegelian process.
Yes,
of
wonderful.
Dialectic.
We love that synthesis. Yes. But can I ask you a question about that? Because sometimes getting from thesis to synthesis is difficult because the antithesis is a pain in the ass. Mm. And I'm wondering what it was like at Austin in terms of the two areas that were probably doing quite a lot of media-related work, namely radio, television, and film, as it's called still, I think.
RTF,
and also communication studies. I don't know so much about communication studies at Austin, but RTF in those days would have had people like Horace Newcomb and J.D. or John Downing, amongst others, I imagine.
Who were two of my closest friends with Tom Schatz.
Tom Schatz,
Janet,
of course.
Janet Steiger, et cetera.
Yes.
Actually, the RTF was a perfect model for what I was doing. There were people like Emil McEnany, J.D., John Downing, who were doing pretty radical media communication studies. And then Horace and Janet and Tom doing television and cinema studies. So my two interests found sort of a grounding in that department. So I got all their students in my seminars that I was on their PhD. So actually, University of Texas, and I'm glad you brought RTF up because that was an important part of my own intellectual and academic life there. I had very productive relations. In some places, there's a big difference between communications studies that tends to be atheoretical, empirical, perhaps conservative, and cultural studies that tends to be more theoretical, humanities, theory-based, etc. But that was not the case at the University of Texas. There were people that were combining these dimensions. So I've had academic environments that have been very nurturing to the kind of multidisciplinary and multi-perspectival work that I've been doing.
That you're interested in. And I guess, yeah, Janet Steiger did a book on audiences.
Correct.
Of course, maybe a couple, actually. And both Tom Schatz and Horace Newcomb were involved in production.
Right.
They'd written scripts and so on, I think, for television.
Yes.
In addition, of course, to being leading scholars. And J.D., John Downing, had been involved in alternative radical media.
He had the book.
He had
radical
book, didn't he?
Media. So as soon as he came to town, we became best friends. He also had the best parties in town, J.D.'s parties. Every time someone would come in town.
And marry people.
And people would marry that met at his.
Did he marry someone?
Yes, he literally married people.
But he had a theological degree.
He had.
In his dark past in the U.K., the old boy had a theological degree. I shouldn't say the old boy.
Not only that, he had he was empowered to literally do weddings. Actually, as my friend Bob Solomon, who was a philosopher. So I think you can pretty easily get empowered to.
Yeah, well, I quite like the idea of being a cultural studies celebrant.
Mm.
And I have seen J.D. wearing an orange caftan on occasion. I actually think I saw him wearing it in Barcelona in the street one night, but then again, I could have made it up.
Mm.
So at some point, though, a few years ago, you decide, you and Rhonda, to to move west, don't you? And you're at UCLA.
Well, that's thanks to George Bush.
This
is a long story. George W. Bush got elected governor of Texas in 1994, and basically the right wing took over the state, including the Texas Board of Regents, who in turn put all right wingers, you know, in the university and put up positions of power. So whereas the University of Texas has been a very friendly, nurturing place where I was able to do everything that I wanted, suddenly I'm confronted with this right-wing power structure in the philosophy department throughout the university. And for a couple of years, my friend and Rhonda's friend, Peter McLaren, had been telling me about this chair in the philosophy of education at UCLA. And suddenly this became interesting.
Right.
Once Texas became increasingly unviable. Also, I had a very low salary in University of Texas in philosophy, shockingly low. And since I'd been single, you know, and got invited all over the world and was living like a millionaire, it didn't matter. But then once I got married, I couldn't pay my visa bill with the salary.
Oh, shut up.
This can be edited. So...
Excuse me, I brought a dowry.
Okay. Not much, but anyway. The Doug Bronda Show.
The Doug Bronda Show. This is when feminism enters Doug's visa card. Mm.
Yes.
Is that right?
So let me tell this story differently. Suddenly, in the mid-1990s, I had life-changing experiences. I married Rhonda Hammer, and I got offered this fantastic job at UCLA, which was a chair in the philosophy of education. And I got this job making the argument that I could teach not only philosophy of education, Paulo Freire, John Dewey, Wollstonecraft, Rousseau, which I'd been teaching their works actually in this modernity course that I taught at the University of Texas. So I was completely qualified to teach philosophy of education. But I also said I would teach seminars in cultural studies, media literacy, and in technology, where I could do cyberculture, which is something we haven't mentioned. This has been another one of my interests. I haven't published as much on cyber studies and new media, but I've been very interested in this and have been studying it and doing it, you know, from the beginning. So it just seemed perfect, this UCLA job, in terms of my interests and my research. Plus, it was just graduate seminars, whereas the University of Texas, I had big lecture courses, Marxism, critical theory, 150 students, modernity, postmodernity, giant classes, culture, philosophy of culture, communication. So I was getting to an age where doing graduate seminars was much more productive for me intellectually, because once you do lectures, you tend to repeat yourself, you know, over the years. And with new graduate students every year, you get different material and ideas and interaction. So actually, UCLA has been very nurturing to my interest in doing this broad array of work on philosophy and theory, but also cultural studies, new technologies, etc.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's wonderful. And one of the interesting... Oh, sorry, Doug. I shouldn't be keying the guests.
Yeah.
One of the things that is a bit at variance between Austin and LA, I should imagine, is that Austin, it's not a college town, it's a congressional town. I mean, it's a capital town. But it also has an extraordinarily vibrant Latino culture and an extraordinarily vibrant music scene. Everybody's heard of South by Southwest, the great music event. But really, year-round, it's quite extraordinary. And it's a place that everybody comes through. But it's also manageable. You know, I think, everything that's going on, and
exactly.
You know how to get in touch with it. Plus, you had this dynamic, fertile, febrile interaction with the Steigers, the Downings, the Schatzes, the Newcombs, et al., and your graduate students.
Rick Slacker.
Right.
Actually with the whole city, because of the alternative views, I was known citywide, and
right.
I also knew all the musicians and filmmakers. And,
right.
And that's actually a good point. When I was in Austin, I knew everything that was going on.
Yeah. And you had the bottle of wine to attract people in, in addition to the chance to be known whenever they were buying a subway token. But you come here, which in some ways is a place that's very important in the history of a lot of the ideas that interest you. I mean, Santa Monica is terribly important in terms of the Frankfurt School guys and where they came. Obviously, downtown LA is important in terms of Jameson's ideas of the postmodern.
The Bonaventure Hotel.
Specifically the Bonaventure Hotel. And also, this is the location, at least in some sense, even if often as much metaphorically as literally, of Hollywood and of television drama, as opposed to television news. So I'm interested in the costs of coming to LA for you intellectually or culturally, and the benefits.
I think the benefits outweighed the cost for the very reasons that you gave. Santa Monica, Hollywood, downtown LA, the whole Southern California environment. In fact, I should put in the biography that I spent most of my first 8 years in Southern California, that during World War II, my father was sent to Hawaii after Pearl Harbor. And I lived with my mother in my grandparents' apartment on South Hope Street, downtown LA, a couple blocks from where the Bonaventure is, which was then Bunker Hill, a very vibrant neighborhood. So I have a history of Southern California, and I love the environment. I like the culture. I like LA, the sprawling, multicultural, multi-ethnic, varied little parts of LA. The museums, the film. We right now live very close to LACMA. So every weekend,
LA County.
The LA County Art Museum, LACMA. So every weekend, we can just walk over and see they're just playing Ernst Lubitsch films, Hollywood comedies. Next week, or this week, they're going to start Sam Fuller films. So there's just an incredible film program at LACMA. Plus, we're close to the Hollywood Cinematheque, the UCLA Billy Wilder Theory. So given that I've done, in the 2000s, film has been my major focus of research in cultural studies, Hollywood, the film culture in LA. It's just perfect.
Makes a lot of sense. And somebody else who we haven't mentioned, who in a sense straddles critical theory and cultural studies, and for whom California was very significant, and of whom you've been a major interlocutor and interpreter, is Baudrillard.
Yeah. Well, Baudrillard I got into in 1970, 71, when I was at Paris for a year studying, just before I got my PhD. Informally, I went to hear the lectures of Foucault, of Deleuze, of Levi-Strauss, not Baudrillard, but most of the big theorists, because I became friends with an Algerian philosophy student who was connected to all these circles of these people that ended up being the great theorists. And I came into reading Deleuze and Guattari, Lyotard, who I heard lecture, Foucault, coming out of Germany, where I'd studied Frankfurt School, Hegel, Marx, Ernst Bloch, I studied with critical theory. So I thought this all went together, that these articulated with each other. So when I read Habermas's Philosophical Discourse of Modernity, that there's some sort of war between the French and the German theories, this to me, you know, made no sense because it all fit together really well.
Well, when you think about a lot of Foucault, it's basically a mixture of Weber and Marx.
Right.
It just isn't acknowledged as such by many of the critics, and perhaps not always by him. Where he is, I think, distinctly opposed to various forms of Marxism is really classical ideology critique,
right.
Kind of an anti-Althusser position, even though you can't have Foucault without Althusser because of the non-humanism. But it's always seemed very odd for me that people keep pitting these things against one another. And if you look at the Foucault-Habermas debate about Kant and what is the Enlightenment, I mean, they start from different places,
right.
And they end up somewhere quite similar, don't they?
Well, yes and no. I mean, I think the antithesis, this is the main point, is a false one. That this is where a Hegelian mode of thought that takes what it wants from Foucault, takes what it wants from critical theory. There are differences. here, and on epistemological levels you have to choose. But in terms of doing your own work, you can do, as Foucault said, use theories as a toolkit just to do different jobs.
A very Wittgensteinian position.
Which is a Wittgensteinian.
So can I pick up on that, though? When you say epistemologically, one has to come to terms with the differences, but you can pick things up, right, magpie-like or toolkit-like. Aren't there risks in that? I mean, if one has the very conventional positivistic view of US social sciences, isn't there the notion that, well, if they don't fit together, if they're not commensurate down the line, then there's something chaotic and non-falsifiable, non-replicable about simply saying, well, in this paragraph I'm Bakhtin, here I'm Gramsci, but now I'm Foucault over here.
Well, first of all, there are contradictions and ambiguities in social reality and the construction of our daily experience. So I don't find contradiction per se and incompatibilities per se problematic. But I see social theory and the cultural studies that we do as more of a mosaic anyway, that's pulling things together and maybe creating odd juxtapositions or relationships, sometimes overlapping, sometimes played off against each other. So to me, it's a perfectly acceptable intellectual mode to combine these different theoretical formations that may have some contradictions and differences.
Yeah. The reason I was mentioning the what is the Enlightenment debate is that it's one of the few occasions when you get these maitre à penser actually nutting heads together. And there's a way there in which one senses that the different starting point is partly that for Habermas, it's always seemed to me, so much of it is about how do you not have another Holocaust? Mm. How do you not take rationality and art to the level where they are in the service of a totalitarian and bigoted state?
Right.
You know, always trying to say, how do you have Goethe and Beethoven and some kinds of democracy and Schiller and Hitler? That's always the problematic, isn't it, at some level?
Habermas argues problematically that mediating between Hitler and German culture is the irrationalist tradition, which is, for Habermas, it's Nietzsche, it's Heidegger, and then the French tradition of Bataille. And Habermas problematically puts Adorno and Horkheimer in that anti-Enlightenment, anti-reason, irrationalist, which, you know, is completely off the wall.
Right.
Actually, I have a great Habermas story. I was very friendly with him over the years, and once I was meeting with him just after he published his Philosophical Discourse of Modernity. So I was pressing him that, well, first of all, he's asking me, why am I writing on Baudrillard and these people? So I was pressing him on his antithesis, et cetera. And so finally said, you know, what really bothers me is the politics. You know, it's fascism that I really see. In Germany, we've seen that irrationalism leads to fascism, et cetera. So I think that Foucault and Habermas are coming from different national cultures. In France, rationality from the Napoleonic Code to positivism, you know, was a repressive force, et cetera.
Right, absolutely.
So a lot of the French theorists were critical of rationality because it was part of an institutional apparatus of repression and domination that they'd experienced, i.e. Foucault, who was more left-wing, gay, just didn't fit into, you know, the French bourgeois culture, had to go to Tunisia, you know, to leave. So obviously he's going to develop a critique of French culture and of rationality. On the other hand, he's not an irrationalist in the way that the Nazis were. You could even argue Nietzsche isn't that much of an irrationalist.
Well, I think there's something there, isn't there, about the philosophy of the limit that just doesn't suit Habermas, because Habermas thinks that rationality can constrain the horrors of bigotry, whereas for Foucault, rationality can actually animate the horrors of bigotry, and that it's Stalinism and,
right,
and Hitler's Holocaust are actually successful mobilizations of some aspects of the modern. No?
I think we've really put our finger into the big difference between a certain tradition of German French theory, Habermas versus these new French theorists, that has to do with rationality and politics, and if you wish, within modernity. That is, Habermas is a rationalist. He thinks reason is the foundation of democracy, that we may have differences, but we debate them, we reach a consensus, we tolerate, accept, try to understand others' points of view. And that's how civilization operates. That's how democracy operates. So it's through reason for Habermas. Whereas, as we suggested earlier, for Foucault, reason can be an instrumental rationality that's part of a repressive bureaucratic apparatus, et cetera, and part of a Cartesian, reductivist, subjectivist, philosophical tradition that's also problematical. So it's very different national cultures and experiences and concepts of reason.
And personal investments.
And personal investments and experiences.
Yeah. Well, my quick Habermas story,
okay,
which is scatological, so I'm going to ask Rosie Ledger, the resident cat, to put her paws over her ears, is that a friend of mine who lives in a lovely beachside suburb in Australia had his house burgled one day when he and his family were out at the beach, I think. They came back and they identified the various things that had been stolen and so forth. It's pretty obvious normally when your house has been burgled. But the thing that gave them most pause was that one of the robbers had defecated in my friend's open copy of A Structural Transformation of the Public Sphere, which was on the dining room table.
So this is a critique of Habermas.
It was a critique of Habermas, definitely from below, one might say.
This is obviously a graduate student would be the suspect for that burglary, that it had a bad experience with Habermas in a seminar that might have been so horrible it led him to a life of crime and a rejection of the bourgeois rationality and social order that Habermas defended.
There we've got it. That must be it, absolutely. Okay, so I wanted to, if I could just go, I'm looking at your books and thinking about some of the other things you've done, and I wondered if you would say a little bit, we've talked about film in terms of Hollywood, a little bit in terms of documentary, but your Emilio D'Antonio work interests me. You mentioned him very briefly. I think he's one of the great US filmmakers, and I wondered if you could just say a little bit about him and what it is that turned you on enough to put together this bravura collection.
Well, I had seen all of Emile D'Antonio's films when they first came out because I was part of the New Left and that was part of our experience. We watched Point of Order. That was the critique of McCarthyism. We saw Rush to Judgment, 1962, on the Kennedy assassination. Vietnam, Year of the Pig, 1968. Milhouse, the book on Nixon, on the Weather Underground. So as D'Antonio's films came out, I saw every one of them, and I was a great admirer of his. And one day when I was in Austin, Texas, teaching, it must have been 1980s, I get a call from Emile D'Antonio.
As you do. You're in your office, and the big man puts one through
Emile D'Antonio calls. He says, Doug Kellner? I said, yes. He says, I'm a big fan of your TV show, and I want to come to Austin, Texas, and I want to be on it. And I immediately told him, I'm, of course, a great admirer of your films, and I would love to, meet you. And he wanted me to organize, which I did, a showing of all his films at the University of Texas. So he actually came, and this was in the 1980s, maybe a year or so before he died of a heart attack, just suddenly.
Was it very sudden?
Because he was in the prime of life. Mm-hmm. So he came to Austin, stayed with me for about a week. We showed all of his films. All of them were packed. I mean, this is amazing. University of Texas, Austin, you think a conservative university. But with minimal publicity, we just packed all of the showings. And we did about 4 hours of interviews for Alternative Views, which are on my website, actually, the Emile D'Antonio interviews.
Can you give us your website address?
Well, it's Douglas Kellner. You can Google.
Just Google Douglas Kellner.
And it's my UCLA website. And it has a video section that has a lot of these alternative views. It has Herbert's Hippopotamus.
Oh, wonderful film.
A documentary on Marcuse.
Looking for Marcuse, really, isn't
so
it?
So a whole lot of different things I have on my website.
Right.
So anyway, Emile D'Antonio came to Austin, and we had a good interpersonal connection. And I think within a couple months after that, I came and visited and stayed at his house in New York. And shortly after that, he died.
Mm.
And one day I got a call after his death from his widow, Nancy D'Antonio, saying that Emile had made me his literary executor. And he had all these diaries, and he hadn't published that much, but you know, some articles on film, interviews and things. And so with Dan Stribal, who was a graduate student in RTF at film at the University of Texas, who specialized in documentary
yes,
film,
yes.
We did an Emile D'Antonio reader. So that's how I got into...
Aren't you working on something now, the FBI paper?
That's a different project. That's Marcuse and the FBI. Actually, I was two literary executors, Emile D'Antonio and Herbert Marcuse. That's, you know, quite an honor for someone of my generation. These were idols, you know, Marcuse of the left and the theoretical, philosophical
yes.
tradition, and D'Antonio also the left, but documentary cinema. So Marcuse had asked me to edit his, actually it was his family that asked me to be the editor of his collected papers. And Rhonda was just alluding to a study I did with Steve Gennaro on Marcuse and the FBI, of how Marcuse, actually Emile D'Antonio, also has 10,000 pages of FBI reports and made a film of his FBI papers called Mr. Hoover and I. It was his last film based on his FBI papers, which, by the way, offer an alternative history. You can see the history of D'Antonio through his FBI papers, Herbert Marcuse through his FBI
right.
papers. So I just finished an article on Marcuse's FBI
That's
papers.
Wonderful. Yeah. I once saw...
So I want to thank the FBI that's listening for compiling all of these documents that help later historians to see what they might have missed.
The FBI is inside that iMac now. It's
yes.
actually assisting in production of this program.
Okay.
I actually once read Herbert Schiller's FBI file in slightly redacted version, and it discloses that when he was at the University of Illinois, a place you mentioned earlier
right.
for the Marxism conference in the 80s, there were informants within his department, or the Institute for Communication Research,
right.
who operated for the FBI. Their names are amongst the material redacted in the file. And the FBI comes around, knocks on the door, and he's red baited, basically.
Right.
So it was happening not only to people like John Lennon.
We shouldn't joke about this FBI surveillance because
no.
a lot of people's careers were destroyed.
Were destroyed. Here in Southern California, the kind of loyalty oaths that were expected, the people, you know, when USC put broadly was the right-wing university and UCLA put broadly was the left-wing university, and... You know, chemists, physicists, town planners especially were just basically sent to the glue factory
right.
as a consequence of this kind of red baiting. We all know about the Hollywood experience of the so-called blacklist, but it happened at all levels of
universities,
government.
Unions,
yeah.
the State
I mean,
Department.
Everywhere.
McCarthy
yeah.
Army hearings, that was Emile D'Antonio's Point of Order film that took down McCarthy, that he made the mistake of going after the Army. And it was okay to get senators, State Department, university professors, Hollywood. But once you went after the military, and McCarthy said, and we're also going to go after the CIA, you knew this guy was finished.
Yeah. right.
You don't take on military and
right.
the CIA. So McCarthy quickly went down.
Yeah. No, it's an interesting moment, isn't it, actually? And in the same way, they turned their targets on Eisenhower, who,
right.
whatever else he may have been. Was understood to be a war hero.
Well, it was seen that McCarthy was reckless. He was also a drunk. That D'Antonio brings out in Point of Order. You can see at the end of the McCarthy Army hearings, he's drunk and slurring and stumbling, etc.
Yeah.
So he's self-destructive, McCarthy.
Yeah, yeah. It's fascinating, isn't it? Now, we haven't got that much more time left. I wanted to do two things. One is to give you the chance to talk about anything we've left out that we should talk about. And then something else brief after that, if I may.
Well, teaching, I guess, pedagogy
yes.
is an important theme that I didn't really reflect on until I came to UCLA and got a chair in the philosophy of education.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I had thought about teaching. I was very influenced by Paulo Freire, but I hadn't really taught it, pedagogy, written about it, etc. So this is an important dimension, I think, of cultural studies is producing media literacy, learning how to read and critique and interpret the media to be media literate as well as book literate. So from the time that I came to UCLA, media literacy has been a focus, which also Rhonda Hammer and I have done several articles together on media literacy. She was pressing media literacy before, you know, we had met and in her own work.
Critical
media literacy.
Yeah.
I'm glad you made that distinction. There are groups that just teach media literacy in a non-critical way that can, you know, be pro-Hollywood, non-critical, etc. But a critical media literacy engages the politics of representation.
Right. As well as production.
As well as production. Gender, race, class, sexuality, sexism, racism, homophobia, critiquing this.
And also a lot of what you've done, Rhonda, is to get students to produce countertexts, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. So I think that's an important part of it. Yeah. Okay, well, here was my question, and this is just sort of the finale. I'm hoping to play some of your favourite music in the pod, depending on the limits of my technology and my successful mobilisation of the doctrine of fair use. And you've got some wonderful choices here, and I wanted to ask you about them. First of all, the most recent, I'm going to go backwards in historical order, from almost 20 years ago, not that I'm trying to date any of us in this room, except Rosie Ledger, the cat who's lying on her back in the sun looking very self-satisfied at age 5. The most recent of these is Public Enemy's amazing album, Strikes Back, and I wondered if you could talk a bit about what it is about Public Enemy that turns you on, gets you going, or whatever.
Actually, I describe this in great detail in my book, Media Culture, where I have a chapter on hip-hop. Let me go back to the beginning, if I may, and I'll come up to, I'll end up with Public Enemy.
Yeah.
When I was young, 12 years old, I was really influenced by Elvis Presley, Elvis the Pelvis, and I had his Sun album, his first albums, that I listened to over and over. And then when we moved, I was about 12 or 13, to New York, I started going to the Alan Freed rock and roll shows. So I went from Elvis to Chubby Checker and Little Richard and Fats Domino and Jerry Lee Lewis, all of whom I saw on these Alan Freed rock and roll shows. So I was really into rock and roll, and I went all the time to these concerts. Later it was Bob Dylan. There was a moment of Peter, Paul, and Mary and folk music. Then there was Dylan, Beatles, Stones, you know, of the 60s. So I was very into rock and roll music. Suddenly in the 70s, it got a little repetitive. There wasn't anything new for a while. Punk, I thought, was really exciting. That was a novelty that I got into. And I got into grunge to some extent, Pearl Jam and some of these groups in the 80s. But my last, I guess, love in popular music was rap and hip-hop, particularly Public Enemy, that I just think is the most political of all the rap music, Chuck D and the Public Enemy group.
Yeah, yeah. So there's something there that's consistent, which is, interestingly, rather like the Foucauldian notion, not just his, but others too, of philosophy at the limit, isn't there? In the way in which Elvis's body and the way that he danced, of course, ripped off, if you like, borrowed, if you like, from African Americans, the whole rock and white rock and roll world. Muddy Waters famously saying of Mick Jagger, "He stole my music, but he gave me my name." But that notion of there being a massive politics to the way the white American body and the white British body get remade through rock. But that's a big part of what you're talking about, not just lyrically, because it's not as though, I mean, sometimes you get lyrics by Dylan or the Beatles or the Stones that make a clear point, like Revolution or Street Fighting Man.
Or a lot of Bob Dylan of certain political stages.
Anti-nuclear war, Hard Rain, and so on. Public Enemy, though, is very overt in this, more so, isn't it?
Right.
It's more like a spoken poetry of an agitprop nature, but with very powerful force underpinning it, musically.
Exactly. That's an important point on Public Enemy. They're also very creative in terms of use of technology and producing layers of sound.
Yes.
So it's not just the lyrics, it's the whole production of every one of their albums is a complex text, which, by the way, is like some of the great Beatles texts. Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band,
yeah.
the White Album. There are conception works where the whole album is basically a work of art,
yeah.
if you want. But I want to go back to the
yeah.
body and rock music. I think this is an important point. It's not just the explicit political movement, but it's rock and roll emancipating the senses and the body and sensuality, etc. We talked about France earlier,
mm-hmm.
and their system of bureaucratic and technological rationality, where they have a very bureaucratic, repressive society with their schooling, their church, their police, etc.
Yeah.
We had in the 1950s in the U.S. a sort of softer version of this, a conformist society. It was the era of the organization man, of
yeah.
middle class consumption, etc., but also of a middle class moralism and conservatism. This was the Eisenhower years, and rock was a revolt against this on the level of the body and of sound, etc. So it was sort of an emancipation of sexuality that preceded the 1960s social and sexual revolution. That rock music got the body moving and, you know, active and more sensual and liberated.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, we see some of Larry Grossberg's work we mentioned earlier is dedicated very much to that ethos and,
right.
and that period. And there is something certainly very exciting about that whole world, isn't there, I think?
It's, and I think cultural studies, Grossberg being one of the most significant, has valorized popular music from the beginning as an oppositional force, a voice of youth culture. This
yes.
is another point to be made, that it's given youth a mode of expression, as well as African Americans, as well as women, eventually.
Except, of course, the other thing we've seen is the way in which rather like commodity feminism, rather like women's sexuality, these things quickly turn into commodity forms, and in the United States, religious forms, such that we see massively successful and popular forms of religious rock music, don't we?
Well, there's a moment of truth in the Frankfurt School theory of the culture industry
yeah.
concerning commodification. The way this very vibrant form is turned into a commodity, and Elvis being a good example of how he became commodified and, if you wish, even castrated, where the early son Elvis, very romantic, very hard-charging, edgy, etc., and even the first RCA album, as soon as Elvis went into the army and got his hair cut, he came back really conservative, just the most commodified forms of music, some elements of genius
yeah.
and some of
that. The Elvis movies that we used to consign to ourselves to watching mindlessly on a Saturday afternoon.
And the movies are a great example, a bad example.
Exactly.
A telling example
yeah.
of the commodification of Elvis. It's actually amazing that the Beatles and the Stones retained their edge of creativity and energy despite being commodified. Bob Dylan, you could say the same. Dylan, in particular, plays a lot of small venues and does a lot of alternative music kinds of things, refusing to be completely commodified. But how many great musicians, filmmakers, popular artists have been commodified? So that's the moment of truth in the culture industry. It can mm-hmm. co-opt energies. I mean, that's an argument about the 60s, the 60s. Rebellion were commodified, long hair, jeans, smoking pot, etc.
Right, right. But, and I think this is where we'll have to wrap it up, one of the great things you taught us, not just in your many books and your seminars and your wine-sharing little old public television make and mini program, and certainly today, is that the force of the dialectic, if I can put it that, is almost unending. You know, it's like that endless chain of signification in Barthes, where you get off it every now and then, but then it comes back, which is to say that the notion of the triumph of commodified rock music is at times fractured. Punk certainly did it. Some of the for-us, by-us elements of rap moguls did it. And most of all, of course, the rise of peer-to-peer file sharing has done it, so that the real aristocrats of the commodified rock industry, nameless artist and repertoire people, nameless executives, have actually been in trouble over the last 5 years. So things do come around, don't they, in
interesting
ways.
It's always, the dialectic never ends, that you can have something that's a radical cultural force commodify, but then within that commodify context, something radical is coming out. Or in the case of audiences, people will use even commodified music to give them impulses that they'll take in new creative radical directions, mixing. Today, young people are taking the commodified popular music and mixing. Actually, this is what Public Enemy did to a certain extent. There was a lot of mixing in rap music where you would take a conservative form and use it as part of a broader mosaic and create a different context for it.
This has been an inspirational podcast. Thanks to Doug Kellner and Rhonda Hammer. I hope Rhonda and Doug are going to come back, and I hope next time Rhonda's going to come front and center. If I can tease her to do so, whatever means available to me. Hope
and someday, maybe I will interview Toby Miller, and we'll do Toby on our podcast. Toby on Toby's podcast.
Yeah, with Debbie Does Dallas as backup. So thanks everybody for listening, and it's been great having you here.
So dope. Listen for lessons I'm saying inside music that the critics are blasting me for. They'll never care for the brothers and sisters right across the country has us up for the war. We got to get them straight. Come on now. They're gonna have to wait till we get it right. Radio stations like question their blackness. They call us a black, but we'll see if they'll play this. Turn it up. Bring the noise. The crowd runs to me, my DJ is warm, he's X, I call him Norm, you know. He can cut a record from side to side, so with the ride, the glide, some people sicker than a suicide. Soul control beat is the father of your rock and roll. Music for what you're for, which and you call a bad man. Making the music, I'm using, but you can't do it, you know. You call demos,
but we ride demos too.
What you gonna do, rap is not afraid of you. Beat is for Sonny Bono,
beat is for your
world. Run the MC for city, DJ couldn't be a man. Stand on his own feet, get you out your seat. Beat is for Eric B and LL as well, hell.
Wax is for Anthrax,
still like your rock bell. Ever forever, universal and will sell. Time for me to exit, Terminator X.
Hear the drummer get wicked.